Welcome everybody to iDeveloper Live episode 2. Honestly, if this is only the second one we've broadcast, we've not done this for the last half an hour at all. And my guests today, in case you weren't here half an hour ago, are Mr. John Fox. Well, he's a host, isn't he? Mr. John Fox, how are you?
I'm dandy. How are you, Scotty?
I don't know. Ask me in about another 20 minutes. And Mr. Drew McCormack, who is now recycled.
Hello, Scotty.
So it's great to have you on board, Drew. Now, I don't think anybody listening online has sort of just come in since we're there, but people who are listening to the recording, they're not going to get the benefit of that wonderful last half hour we've just done. So I'm going to ask you to tell us again who you are.
Okay, for the third time today, I'm Drew McCormack. I run a company called The Mental Faculty. It's a one-man company. And I have a website, mentalfaculty.com, and the primary application that we develop at the Mental Faculty is called Mental Case, and it's an app for putting things into your head. It's a study app for students. And the website for that is macflashcards.com.
Now, everybody out there in the chat room has heard that so many times now that it's going to be ingrained into their brain.
Exactly. Good marketing.
Excellent. Well, we're going to skip the news this week because basically there is none. It's just been a really dull and boring week. And when we did try the news in our first attempt at iDeveloper Live episode 2, it was rubbish. It was completely and utterly rubbish. So, John, I am going to ask you the question again. You know, you wanted Drew on the show. Why did you want Drew on the show?
Well, because for selfish reasons, because I've been, you know, working hard to try and ship an iOS version of Memory Miner, and it's made me think about two things. One is how to simplify the application to fit better in the kind of mold of applications that are in there, and at the same time thinking there's a lot of discussion recently about price points, and I don't think it's all just about, you know, race to the bottom. And it's certainly a strong aspect to it. But I think that maybe there's something new that the iOS Mac, you know, the iTunes store for applications is coming to the Mac, and it can't help but change things a lot for both developers and for consumers. And there have been some competing blog posts and Twitter remarks between Kevin Hochter and Drew McCormack. So mostly because I'm a snarky kind of guy, I just wanted to kind of turn it into a slugfest. But then my professional side said, no, let's have a reasoned discussion about it. So let's try and have a reasoned discussion plus snarkfest.
So, I mean, can we have a reasoned discussion when we've only invited one side of this argument onto the show?
Well, I will place Kevin Hochter.
You will play Kevin Hochter. This is like Hollywood now. His name was
I will be
Kevin.
Very reasonable. I'm not sure about Kevin, but I will be very reasonable. Don't worry about that.
See, Kevin is arguing in the chat room about there was no recent discussion, but he's an old man and his memory's just gone. That's all. So, Drew, give us an oversight of the sort of the opinions that you have been spouting, which has caused John to bring you on.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's what John summarized it pretty well, actually. It sort of all started with a few comments on Twitter, and Kevin and I got in a bit of a, let's call it a discussion. It bordered on sort of name calling at various times, but we've since managed to sort of tame it down, and it's worked out to be a sort of a discussion. He made a blog post, I made a blog post, and it largely comes down to pricing. You know, how much should apps be worth? My overall view is that probably the Mac App Store will mean that prices will come down a bit. I'm not talking about a race to the bottom like you had in the App Store, the iPhone App Store. I don't think that we'll all be selling software for 99 cents anytime soon, or indeed ever probably for the Mac. But I do think with a new audience, the Mac App Store should bring a whole new audience to the platform. People that have never bought indie software before, perhaps they don't even know you can buy indie software. I'm hoping that it will bring a whole new audience, that people will see the Mac App Store in their dock, and that they will buy independent software. And these people are probably not the same sort of buyers that we have now for the Mac. People who buy software for the Mac now are either let's call them power users, good, you know, they know what they're doing on the Mac, really do. or they are just other developers. So if you look at sort of independent software developers, you know, the bigger independent software developers, and you look at what sort of products they offer, often they just offer developer tools or things like that. Things that certainly tools that appeal to a sort of a well-trained user. And if you look for other types of apps that are sort of appeal to a lower, a less experienced user, let's say that, there aren't that many. I think it's more difficult to make software and sell it for a less trained user. And I think we'll see a lot of these less trained people coming into the Mac App Store and buying software. At least that's my hope. And what I expect from that is that will bring. In order to reach those people, I think you'll have to drop prices a little bit. And I think Apple have sort of given indications about that when they demoed the Mac App Store. They had as an example Pages at $19.99. I think they might be sending signals out to developers. I think you were saying this last week even. That you know, $20, that's about what an app should cost. You know, a standard consumer app. Of course, there'll be exceptions. Some apps are very complex. Some apps appeal to power users, and they will probably stay more expensive. But I think if you're running just a standard consumer app, I expect it to come in sort of the $20 to $30 range instead of the $40 range which you're currently looking at. And Kevin's view was basically that we should just stick by our guns. Not lower the price for anything, and I think he's worried about a race to the bottom, and that's one of the reasons he's saying, you know, his view is basically that software has intrinsic value, and that you should not lower the price just to try to get some more users or anything like that. It's got a fixed intrinsic value, and that's what you should sell it for. Whereas my view is, yeah, software is different, completely different to every other product on the planet, because you can manufacture as many copies as you like for nothing at all, apart from support costs. So the trick in terms of being a developer is to try to find what's most profitable. And if that means coming down to $20, I'm happy to do it. Or if it means going to $50, raising the price, I'm happy to do that too. It doesn't matter to me what the actual price is, as long as my profits are maximized.
Okay, now, I mean, let's just take a step back for a moment, Drew, because it's not that long ago that you were tweeting that you didn't think the Mac had, as a platform, had a future at all. So is the recent announcement changed your mind on that?
You got me with that one. No, I don't. Not really. I mean, I wasn't really ever saying that the Mac would disappear in a month or two or anything like that. I was talking about a range of 3 to 5 years. And I was worried that consumer software would disappear on the Mac. Basically, I think that there will always be Macs for a long time to come, for professional users, for developers, for designers, for all those people that can't do their work on an iPad or whatever. So I wasn't ever saying that the Mac would die, but I was worried about the future of consumer software on the Mac. I thought that maybe, for example, people wouldn't buy MacBooks anymore. They would just buy an iPad instead of a MacBook. And one of the things I actually said in this blog post that you're referring to, I assume, is actually that one of the ways that Apple could help sort of stop this problem would be to introduce a Mac App Store. And they've done that now, so who knows? I mean, I still think in the long term that consumer Macs are probably doomed, but at least in the short term, we can make a few bucks, let's put it that way.
And I mean, Keith Alperin has just said in the chat room. Sorry, John, I've just totally ignored you trying to get in there. I'll come back to you in a moment. In the chat room, you know, he's been working on his Mac app again this week, and you know, has just started to remember how much more work has to go into a Mac app than maybe into an iPhone or an iPad app. And I mean, it did strike me at WWDC, not this year because I didn't get to go, but the year before during the ADAs, that. A lot of the awards for great iPhone apps were won by sort of developers who were working solo, whereas all of the apps that were winning ADAs in the Mac section, you know, teams of sort of 6, 7, 8 people were going up on stage who'd input into this app. And so, you know, we're looking, you know, just on that, you know, very rough sort of, you know, overview of the difference between Mac and iPhone development, you know, can the quality of Mac apps that we have been used to survive based on the App Store model and the model you've just said of, you know, consumers, you know, being more of a throwaway buy thing?
That's a good question, actually. Yeah, it's difficult to say, but I get the feeling that Apple, I mean, with Lion, we've seen that with Lion, that Apple are trying to push the two platforms together. And I wouldn't be surprised if either in Lion or whatever comes after Lion, basically they will have one operating system or something that looks like one operating system. For example, I can definitely see a day when they'll bring UIKit in some form into Mac OS. And then the lines between a Mac app and an iPad app might blur a little bit. Of course, there's a difference in the way you interact with them in terms of touch and things like that. But you know, with these multi-touch mice and things like that, these differences also blur a little bit. So, will we see a lot worse? I don't think we'll see. I mean, we'll still get the same great apps that we've already got now. They're not going anywhere, and I'm sure those developers will continue to charge a lot, and they deserve to charge quite a lot because they are very hard, very well written apps. Basically, the Panics of this world, they write great apps, so they deserve to charge more. I'm hoping that there will be just a lot more people that would like to develop Mac apps and that are good at it, but being able to make a living at it. That's really the, until now, a lot of people that, you know, that would have liked to have developed Mac apps just simply couldn't make a living from it. They had to move to the iPhone or whatever.
So let me jump in here because a couple of things have come to mind. I think we can all kind of stipulate, we all agree that it doesn't do anybody any good, either consumer or developer, if you can't make a reasonable business proposition of it. And I think that there's the challenge is really is getting a sufficient audience. And I think that's really where it comes down to, because In the app stores, we see it where it's kind of driven by list, you know, top 100 or top this. If you can't kind of be successful in that game, you're not going to be heard of. Now, everybody says, and it's totally true, you have to think of the app store as just that. It's a distribution mechanism. You're responsible for your own marketing. But then it comes down to the point that everybody, there's so much competition going on to attract people's attention. And so you have to kind of reduce the friction at all points. You know, the reason why the iTunes store lets people buy music and why they're successful for it is it's so easy. You can try things with little risk. 99 cent, you know, piece of music on a, you know, something that you like. 99 cent app, low risk. $10, low risk. It's kind of in the macchiato latte thing. Now, I think that if I'm correct, you know, Nother Software, Group Smarts, and Mental Faculty, we're all kind of one app shops, right? We have one major application. I think maybe there's some other ones. And the other thing I think that's interesting about it is that these are both applications that have kind of two aspects to it. If I think about MoneyWell, there's the aspect of entering in purchases, and even Kevin spoke about that, about the fact that you need to make it very quickly while you're out there, make purchases, you know, data entry. And then there's another aspect of it, which is kind of trends, looking at longer terms. And I think it's similar with you know, mental case. There are exercises, then patterns that you can look at over time. And then, of course, the same with memory miner, you know, annotations of photos, little bits of memory, and then looking at trends over time, which to me, in a way that it makes it so that can you have, the question really comes more along the line of, how complicated can a single application be? And aren't we turning around to a world where instead of a developer thinking about shipping a single application, should they not be thinking about kind of a number of related applications that fit together? Or another way of thinking about it is I've seen a number of developers, Boinks comes to mind. You know, I was looking at Photo Magico, and I think they have like three different versions of it. They have like the super, super professional version and kind of like the consumer easy version. And I think they have like some group or family version. And I know Omni has done similar things where they've had kind of pro versions with all the features and simpler versions. So the question I'm thinking about is, what's the best strategy for a developer that has kind of a robust, kind of fairly complicated application? Should they try and do the, let's make a feature-rich, super pro version that we charge top dollar for, and then a simpler version? Or should we try and think about breaking up the application into smaller bits, kind of, let's say, maybe the widget press approach?
Yeah, I mean, I'm inclined to. Firstly, I think maybe what you're getting at is that the price, if the price does come down, that you think maybe you won't be able to make as much money as you were making before. But and this is certainly the argument that Kevin's been using against me that if you sell an app for $20, you can't make any money from it. You won't be able to survive. But I disagree with that. I think that you will be more than compensated for by just the extra sales. So I don't think that it's necessary to radically upheave your whole strategy in terms of developing more apps or anything. I think you can simply find a good price point for the app that you've got, and hopefully you'll be able to sell a lot more volume just with the app you've got. You don't need to go out of your way to create new apps or anything like that. I don't expect it to be like the iPhone App Store. I just don't expect that enormous excess of supply that they have on the iPhone App Store. It is difficult to write a Mac app, so I don't think it's going to be swamped with all these new apps that just like the iPhone App Store was. I don't expect that at all. So I would say, and certainly what I'm planning to do is just to play it reasonably cool, and try to sustain the price to some degree, like Kevin suggests, but also look at not be closed to the idea that maybe I'll have to come down a bit in price to get more users, to basically attract this new group of people that aren't used to spending $40 on an app. So yeah, so my feeling is that you should just keep doing things the way you are. Now, of course, not everything can stay the same because, for example, nearly all developers now use time-limited demos as a way of sort of giving users a chance to try the application out before they buy. And it looks like that's not going to be possible. I think it's unlikely that Apple will allow that because they never have allowed it for the iPhone. So why would they all of a sudden turn around and do that now? That means that you need to develop a new approach, basically, and I think the way to go there is really the way that the iPhone App Store is sort of handled. If you've got an app that people really do need to try out before they can buy, because for example it's quite expensive, I think the way to go there is to actually just develop a light version, which is allowed by Apple, and just make a version that's not as fully. That does something useful, probably, hopefully, but not it's not as fully fully featured as your main app, and hope that people will then upgrade that way.
My concern is over this that if let's say $20 becomes the upper end of what could be bought, someone like Kevin, and I'm sorry that we've made Kevin the center of the show, but he is such a hero, I guess, to us all. But he basically can then take the attitude, or probably has to take the attitude, is what do I need to put into this application to be able to charge $20 for it and then no more? Which means actually, I think we're going to lose some of applications that have excellent stuff in because they are, and maybe some less, well-used features and that sort of way, because they have the ability to charge a higher price, because they're now charging a lower price, but they're never necessarily going to get the volume that something like an Angry Birds is going to get. They basically say, I'm going to deliver the minimum that I can for the highest price, as opposed to just delivering the software I want to deliver.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I think it's a bit dangerous just to think too much about how much software is worth because it's really just your own perception of what you think $40 is or $50 is or whatever. Just you're saying, for example, that people will only do $20 worth of work on their app because it's only worth $20. But if they're selling three or four times as much than at $40, say, then their profit is more, so generally. So,
But
yeah, I
I don't believe that all apps are driven by price, and actually people would be quite happy to pay $40, but not necessarily if they couldn't see it first. And I don't think it's necessarily true that there are certain apps that because they're $20 cheaper, it will sell twice as many. They're only ever going to sell the amount they were going to sell because of the market they're in, and they would have sold almost at whatever price you put them in there for.
Right. I mean, I agree with that. There are certain, I think Kevin's app is probably a good example of that, because it's a financial app and people are willing to pay, you know, good money for financial apps, particularly when there's competitors that are much higher in price, like Kevin's competitors. So, no, I agree with that. There are certain apps, maybe Kevin has got a good point for sticking to his guns, but I think there are other apps, you know, my app's a good example. I think when I first introduced the app, I actually listened to these podcasts, and I probably listened to Kevin saying you should raise the price of your software because people will perceive it as being worth more. And I did exactly that, and my sales plummeted. So it depends very much on the actual app as to where that sweet spot is. And I've since found with my application that by actually dropping the price, because I'm appealing to students, dropping the price to $20 actually really was the difference between quitting my day job and just doing it as a hobby. So it really depends a lot on the type of software. And I agree, there's pro software, which will always be high priced and should be high priced, because like you say, dropping it to $20 is not going to sell more. But there will be other apps. Memory Miner is probably a good example of this. You know, a lot of consumers would be interested in Memory Miner. If you drop that price a bit, some of these people who would never have bought software before might consider buying it.
Well, can I jump in now, Scotty?
Feel free, John. Feel free.
Okay. So, you know, there's a kind of a discussion point, a way of framing things among venture capitalists, where they always ask people coming to them with a new idea, saying, "Is your software? Is your product? Is it aspirin or is it a vitamin?" Meaning that does it solve a pressing problem that people have? Oh my God, I have a headache, I need relief. Or is it a vitamin saying, hey, I'd like to have more energy, I'm going to, whatever, eat more vitamin C or vitamin B. And I think that you've hit something here, Drew, and that, you know, there are applications that people need. I mean, and that it also comes down to is like, Where is the value for it? Is it entertainment? So, you know, Angry Birds, I see, first of all, it's a great application. And I don't buy games, but, you know, I bought it and my son loves it. And I looked at it and think, it's kind of interesting. But generally speaking, there are kind of like these little small applications that if you lower the price, you hit a sweet spot and people just really like it and makes them happy during the day. An application like Moneywell or Mental Case or Memory Miner requires an investment in time on the part of people who are doing it. So it's more, there's a different aspect of it. It's not even, I don't think it's so much of you know, is it worth $20 or with it worth $40? I think it's more like, how much of my time and effort is it worth? So then it comes down to a question of kind of two things, I think. A trust in the company that's selling it. Right, because that takes time to develop. You know, is your software of high quality? Do you give good customer service? If I buy the software and I invest time in it, are you going to be around? You know, are there going to be new versions? And that's something that kind of only comes over time. But the second thing is, as I said, is kind of, am I willing to put the time into it? So I think there it comes down to the idea that if you have smaller applications that give you good bits of success, however you do that, you know. That builds confidence in the user that they can take the time to invest in it and they'll get the return, whether it's entertainment or relief. And I think that's how we should be thinking about things a little bit.
Yeah, so you're basically saying that there will be a new type of app, basically, you know, a lot of apps filling that sort of you know, $10 to $20 range, maybe, that's, you know, RSS readers and Twitter clients and games and things like that, sort of throwaway apps, basically, like on the iPhone.
No, well, that's not quite it. I think it's that you have, since you're always competing for people's attention, just in the initial point, then it comes down to the question of risk. Can I take the risk to, it's not just can I afford to take the risk of spending $40 and being disappointed. I don't think that's it so much is, if I buy this and I have to spend time doing it, will I enjoy it? And I think that if the applications themselves require too much effort to kind of fill themselves out to prove the return, as I said, kind of back to what I was saying, if it's headache and you take a piece of aspirin and you get relief in 20 minutes, you're happy. and then you don't think about it again. And that's how I kind of think about these small entertainment applications. I need something to do. I'm bored. It's aspirin for your headache. The things that are kind of nutrition or vitamins, something that is over a long term, you have a challenge to trying to explain to the user that they're going to be a long-term benefit, but that the long-term benefit comes from a series of short interactions with your application that yield some return on investment, some happiness, some insight, some whatever. And I think if that's the way it is, then I think that the applications, it does change the nature of them. But to kind of even get in the game, they probably have to be, at a more popular price. And I think that we have to kind of step back a little bit. The reality is I don't know how things are in Europe, but there's a recession here in America, despite what people say. And I think that there is a certain price sensitivity because you think, okay, if I'm going to spend $40 then and get one application, should I have bought two applications? That's I don't think there's any hard and fast rules there. You have to look at it from different points and work on it from different points.
Drew, I'm going to ask you sort of three questions in one, really.
Okay.
Based on a couple out of the chat room and one that I've been thinking of myself, and I think they sort of work together. But feel free to just throw some of them out if you wish to. One of the points just been made in the chat room is, do you feel that actually the price of software is more about who you're selling to than what the software is? The second part to go with that is, for you, how'd you zero in on what that sweet point is then for those people you're selling to? And if that is the case, that it's about, being able to control who you're selling to as opposed to, what you're actually selling. How much is that going to change when actually the price is being dictated more by the environment you are selling from than the people you are selling to? Does all that make sense?
I think so. I might have
Okay,
trouble remembering the questions, but anyway,
give an answer and I'll keep butting in with extra bits to say, but you haven't answered this bit yet.
let me think. So the first one was whether you are worried more worried about the people that you were selling to than the
Yes,
actual
software is
product.
valued based on who you're selling it to, not actually what's in the software.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely. I actually do actually think that's correct. Yeah, the price that what people pay is determined by who they are, and of course, you have to when you're making any product, you have to think about who your customer is and whether it's software or not. You need to be able to figure out whether there's a market and what is a market. A market is just a bunch of people with a similar sort of disposition in some way that want to buy something. And I absolutely think you do have to think about these things. So, for example, my software is targeted at students, and you have to think about, okay, a student, what sort of demographic is that? They don't have that much money, maybe. They are inclined probably to piracy. I know I was when I was a student, and but they do need to learn things for classes. So, give them an app like Mental Case, which is cheap, so they're not tempted to pirate it. For a start, just they'll actually buy it instead of pirating it because there are advantages to buying too as well. Of course, you get support and things like that. But they can also learn. It's useful for their classes. And what was the last one? I've lost the train of thought on that. But anyway, the point there is that yeah, I absolutely have to think about your customer. And when I was first developing Mental Case, an interesting point. I actually didn't. I had the wrong people in mind for the app. I thought of myself basically as the customer, and I thought of how I would use the application. I wasn't a student at the time, and it took me a long time to realize that the people that this app was for was were students. And when I realized that, that was really when I figured it all out, and I was able to quit my day job, and things went well after that because I could target the people that were most advantaged by the software. And the same is true of every other software. Of course, you've got with MemoryMiner and with NoThirst software, as well, you have to be prepared to target the particular demographic that's interested in the software. So Moneywell, for example, is it's financial software. So it's financial software for the home user, but it's still people that are interested in organizing their fa finances. So you have to figure out how much those people are prepared to pay, and that will be different to how much a student is prepared to pay. That should be obvious. Yeah, so coming back to the second part, I think there was how do you determine a sweet spot? I think that's just kind of related to what I was just saying. For mental case, I actually did a lot of experimentation, basically raising and lowering the price because I didn't know at the start what who would be using it, what a reasonable price was. And I heard other people saying, yeah, you should raise the price because if you raise the price, people will perceive it as being worth more and then you'll actually increase sales. So I listened to all of this stuff and I tried it out and it just didn't work for me. It didn't work at all. So I ended up lowering the price to increase sales and increase profits. And that did work for me because probably because of, I'm targeting a particular demographic. So it depends very much on the application. In terms of, I'm saying $20 will be the price of the App Store, as a sort of a, average price or whatever. That comes from just sort of, I haven't plucked that completely out of the air. It's just by looking at the other app stores, really. The iPhone app store apps sort of go up to $5 in general, I would say between $0 and $5. And if you look at the iPad's apps, they're sort of below $10. And I think Mac apps would fit in sort of $20 and below, or maybe $30 and below. But I think $40, $50, that's getting a bit too high for your sort of basic consumer app. I think then you're moving into pro territory. If you're a pro, you've got a pro app, then that's fine, or at least a power user app. That's okay. But for most, for an app like Mental Case, definitely, I was thinking of increasing the price, and now I'm definitely not going to go over $30. Probably closer to $20 even. And what was the? I've forgotten the last
Well,
question.
my last question was, you've been free to put the price up and down and do whatever, totally basing it on what you think people are happy to pay. Do you feel being in an app store environment, actually, the environment is going to determine that price as much as anything else?
Yeah, I do think that, and that's what makes software so different to everything else. Because if I was making some electronic product in China, and I would know exactly how much everything cost, and I could base my price on that, on the cost of getting it distributed and the cost of making it, designing it, and whatnot. Now, software is completely different. There is, of course, a development and design cost up front, and then there is after-sales support costs, which is actually does depend on your sales volume, but that is the only thing that depends on your sales volume. The rest, the actual manufacturer of a software product is a copy command. So, yeah. So, I actually, do, I think you actually you can use that to your advantage because it depends on the context. So, in the past, we've developed this whole system of selling indie software, with time-limited demos and all this stuff, and we've sort of sorted out a price range. And we've sorted out a group of users, basically power users in general, I would say. And all of that is about to change. All of that, we're going to a completely different context. Now we're going into an app store where, yes, you'll probably have some of these power users, but you will have a lot of other people as well. And I think the advantage of writing software is you've got a lot of control over the price. You can choose the price that'll give you the most profit. You don't have to. You're not limited by cost of components and things like that. So, I absolutely think you should take the context into account when you're selling software and not be too dictated by what worked in the past, for example. I'm not sure that what worked in the past on the internet will be the same as what works in the Mac App Store. That's basically my view.
So basically, we need to be treating this just like the internet changed the way we sold software. It allowed people such as yourself and Kevin to become independent software vendors because of the distribution mechanism, and that made a total change to the way software is sold. We need to view the future as just a bigger, as bigger change again, and rather than fighting it, have to work with it.
That's exactly right. I think, if you went into the internet age trying to sell your software for, $1,000, like Lotus or whatever it was cost on a CD, I'm sure that, an indie developer would have had a lot of trouble doing that. You have to adapt, and the price of software now is probably, I think, a lot cheaper than it was back in the days when you had to order a disc and all that stuff. So, Yeah, I think that's the key, to be flexible and try to keep an open mind, not rush into anything, and just discuss things like we are discussing them now, and like I've been discussing them with Kevin.
But here's the thing, is that you can adjust the price, but I think you can lower the price, but I think it's pretty hard to raise the price on a product that's already been out there. So if you're, that's the thing. I mean, it sounds happily for you, Drew, that, you know, you started out with a certain price point following the advice you had, and then you lowered it and you kind of found your sweet spot. But do you think you could ever raise the price for Mental Case now and keep the same product?
Well, I think so. With an upgrade, you can definitely raise the price if you have a major upgrade. That was what I was trying to say. That I did actually try these ideas of raising the price. I did actually do that. I raised the price from you know, $34 or something to $39. You know, in the expectation that maybe that would increase the sales, because people would have a better perception of the software. And in my case, that didn't work. And I know it did work for Kevin. So I think it depends on the software, but I think you can. I think people always say you can't raise the price, but I think you can, because the people that have already bought the software, they don't care what the price is. They don't care if you raise the price. And the people that are going to buy the software, they don't know that it was cheaper yesterday. So I don't think it's as big an issue as it seems. I mean, I've done that with iPhone apps as well. I've raised the price, lowered the price, tried to figure out what was right. And I've never once had a complaint, you know, oh, well, you've raised the price since yesterday. Or, you know, it's been very few and far between. So I think it's definitely possible to do that. But that doesn't mean I would raise. I mean, I think Kevin is right to sort of go in a bit careful. So I'm going to go. My plan is to go into the Mac App Store sort of at the high end of my price range, and maybe do a few sales to sort of test the water. See if I drop the price $10. Does the volume go up enormously, you know, over sort of several weeks, not just a spike, but actually does it steady state at a higher level as well? And use those sales as a way to sort of figure out, you know, where should I be?
Okay, I mean, let me throw this one into the mix then. I think the iPad in many ways changed the model again, just like the iPhone did, although it is noticeable there are, yeah, the number of iPad apps is not growing in anything like the same way as the phone apps do. And maybe that's just a different point altogether. But I have a colleague who basically has decided the best way to get a high price for what he's doing, because it's a lot of work in what he's doing, is effectively the basic app is free. And then he uses in-app purchase to purchase additional functionality within the app, being that if actually you are a power user and you want all 10 bits of major functionality that his app does, they're all sort of sold at sort of between $5 and $10 a time. So you actually do end up paying sort of, you know, $50, $60 for the full app, whereas actually if you're just a real basic user, you might pay as low as $5, $10 for the app, because, you know, but he is specifically having to design his application to allow that modular type of usage within it, but still provide the full experience to do it. I mean, is that possibly a way that the larger applications and applications such as Kevin's and these Memory Miner is going to have to go? It's about just like everything is with TV and everything else, is about choice of having something when you want it. We need to start doing apps where actually I only want to buy that bit. I don't want the rest of it. I just want that bit.
Yeah, I think that that's the way it'll go. You know, we've used time limited demos in the past to try to force people to buy the whole app. And on the iPhone, it certainly works more with sort of light. You get a free light version and you can use in-app purchase to upgrade, like you're saying. And when in-app purchase comes to the Mac, I think it will. I don't know if it'll be there initially, but I think it will. When that happens, I think you will see that model more and more used. That people either give away a light version or give away a very cheap, sell a very cheap version, and that you can buy functionality and increase the sales that way.
John, you sell a full functional, quite a large, reasonably expensive application. I mean, how does that sound to you? Horrifying?
No, that's how I would like to do. I was about to jump in. It's like, as far as I understand, there is no in-app purchase. You can't do like the QuickTime to the QuickTime Pro thing. I think, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about should you have, you know, it sucks that we can't do demos. And I don't know. I'm of the opinion that Apple's probably never going to allow you to do demos in the Mac App Store, time-limited demos. And I think even when you have them, you know, even Matt Gemmell had once said that time-limited demos that are kind of based on calendar time never seem to work. And that seems to be my impression as well. I see a lot of people who kind of download the application. They realize that it takes time to use it. They don't have time because, you know, they thought they were going to spend an afternoon with it, but then life got in the way. And then they 2 weeks later or whatever, the time has expired and they're unhappy. And so, you know, if I had to do it again, I would try and say, well, you know, some formulas are the number of times you launch it. Maybe that works. But I think that it's a good idea to be able to, if you're going to get an application in people's hands, it shouldn't disappear in some way. It's better to have it that it still works, but, you know, whatever, some it just stays in a simple feature state. I do think that this kind of thinking about your application is instead of just a single thing, almost like a group of channels. I mean, like HBO on cable TV in America, there's several, there's HBO East, West, HBO Comedy, that type of thing. And, you know, so that kind of that approach of saying what you're doing, in a way, you're landing a mini app store for your company on the customer's, you know, desktop. It may be for separate applications or complementary applications or just a stepped set of features in a single application. However it is, I think that it helps to think in that way. And I hope that there is a mechanism for doing that. And then it becomes a kind of an application design problem where you have to try and think, what is the baseline functionality that you have that gives enough flavor and value for your software, but doesn't kind of give everything away? And how do you leave high-end bits? The other thing that came to mind is a psychological thing. This is very interesting. You know, on Flickr, they said that one of the most successful things they did was the pro badge, that when people, that they got all these people on the Flickr because it was free, you could get started. And in fact, they have very liberal kind of storage and network things, so people using Flickr for free can really enjoy it without ever having paid a penny. But what really turned people over to start buying things was that they wanted, when they made comments on somebody's photograph, that your account had the little pro badge to it. And I vaguely, and it's totally true. And there's something similar, I think, that Omni, I don't know whether they wrote it or maybe I just surmised it, but they said that when they offered pro versions of their software, just by making that differentiation, the fact that they had a low price point entry eased the way a little bit. People said, okay, I can get in the game at a price that I can afford. And that gives a level of confidence. And then when they see, oh, but there's the pro option, time and time again, people want to feel pro. They want to feel like they're sophisticated, but they can't get there if there's not a fallback position for them. So I think psychologically, there's that aspect to it.
That's an interesting point. And in fact, Omni seem to get the best of all worlds, because actually even their entry-level apps are quite high-priced apps.
Yeah, Omni, it's a good question about Omni. It's difficult to say because they've got competitors that have such as Cultured Code, that have you know, lot apps that are also reasonably expensive, but not, but still half price of Omni's apps. So it'd be interesting to know who makes the most profit in that sense, whether Cultured Code's approach or whether Omni's approach is the best. That really comes back to what we're talking about here, where, you know, is price important? Do you make up the volume, you know, make it up in volume or not?
Well, I think now it's time for the smackdown, because people have been saying, you know, this is what I'm going to do, this is what I'm going to do. So it's going to be interesting, you know, to see what happens. I don't know, when we revisit this discussion 6 months from now, after we've had kind of a full quarter of the Mac Store, and maybe even that's not going to be long enough. But I think that there are definitely different approaches. And I think if I were to say one thing is, The problem has to be looked at from multiple angles, and I think you have to look at it from multiple angles. And I think that that's probably the best thing that comes out of these types of discussions, because, you know, you just have to you can't have a hard and fast position, I don't think. You can't say, I've made my decision, this is the you know, the one way in the light. I just don't think that's the case.
Well, I think only time is going to tell. I think the one thing that is obvious is that maybe not 6 months, but definitely in 2 years' time, the decisions you make about becoming a software developer for the Mac platform and the way you approach it, I think, are going to be very different to what we've been used to. And we need to get ready for change. And if you're a person who doesn't like change or is not prepared to go with change, you're probably going to be in trouble.
There's something else that just came to mind. I was reading Thomas Friedman column. I think it was from this past Sunday, where he was like saying, he was talking about how the way that society is changing, everybody has to think of themselves as an artisan, whether you're a janitor or an iPhone developer. And I was thinking about that. Yeah, if you make the wrong decisions as an iPhone developer, you will become a janitor, but an artisanal janitor.
There we are, John prophesying the future of many of our audience. In fact, we've just had someone drop off the chat room. Maybe they've gone to do the cleaning because they just didn't make enough sales. Well, I'm going to draw us to a close there because we've been online for a while now. I know we've not actually been that much content, but the technical difficulties at the beginning have not been here a while. So I'm going to thank you very much, gentlemen, for an interesting discussion. I want to thank everyone in the chat room who've been having an interesting discussion as well on something totally different, but seem to have been enjoying themselves and making the occasional comment. So it's I really enjoy having people just popping things in the chat room because it just widens the conversation, I think. Now, Drew, I know you've said it about 5,000 times already, but I think I'm going to give you one more opportunity to market to the multitude of students who probably listen to this podcast, or
exactly.
All three of them, and see if you can get your $19 or whatever it is out of them.
Exactly. Okay. I'm Drew McCormack, and my company is The Mental Faculty. Mentalfaculty.com is the website. There's a blog there as well if you're interested in some of these things. I've been blogging there on the mental faculty, just on mentalfaculty.com, about this. And the big product, the flagship product, is Mental Case. It's a study app for putting things into your head, and you can find that at macflashcards.com.
And John, people know who you are by now, but yeah, I just I see you in your poverty. You need to sell more. Come on, tell us what you're selling.
I sell a product called Memory Miner, and you can find out all about it at memoryminer.com. And I'm also the author of an upcoming book for pragmatic programmers on building applications with Cappuccino. And you can also read my blog at memoryminer.com/blog, although I have a blog post I've been working on that I haven't posted yet, but it's coming soon.
Okay, and I'm Scotty from iDeveloper TV, and I've been responsible for the fiasco at the beginning of of this broadcast. We haven't had time for the sponsors today because of everything going on there, so they won't get charged for this episode. I have to say that because there's at least one of them in the chat room. I don't want them asking questions, but we'll give a shout out to RemObjects and their RemObjects framework, WidgetPress with Formentry, Model Baker, and Macroscope with their Xcode plugin, which the name of has gone totally from my head, even though I use it every day. Come on, Copilot, that's the one, for sort of being sponsors of the shows either side of this show, because we're in there. So we're going to sign off now, and just going to say, until next time, you take care.
No, that was beautiful. Are we off the air?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, then I will say one last thing. You mentioned the word fiasco. Did you know that fiasco in Italian means flask? And since this has been a fiasco, you should go find your flask of whiskey.
That sounds good to me. That sounds good to me. That's what I will go and do. ¶¶